next case will be 07-1029, Michael Simon Design, the United States.
May it please the court. Sitting with me council table today is Barbara Williams, the attorney in charge of the Justice Department's International Trade Field Office. The decision of the trial court, and more recently the Wilton decision, promotes a system in which how a good is decorated is far more important than the nature of the good itself.
But that issue, I mean, you've already got a statutory fix to that. So we're just talking about the killers, set items that missed the time.
No, we actually don't have a statutory fix. But the statutory change is interesting in that it did not change the language of any of the provisions in the heading, but it provided the exact same explanation of what that heading means as the amended explanatory notes. It is binding, but as we indicated in our brief,
but the explanatory notes are not.
No, the explanatory notes are not binding. However, they are certainly the official interpretation of the tariff provisions up through the six-digit level.
Is this panel agree in the government's view to overrule our precedent based on the explanatory notes?
This panel is free to move on from that precedent based on changing circumstances. You now have different tools at your disposal, courtesy, for one, of the United States Supreme Court in the Mead decision, and you also have, in the Midwest case, you also referred to the explanatory notes. They weren't as clear as they are today in excluding utilitarian goods. The Midwest and the Park v. Smith cases you applied a two-part test. You adopted that test. It seemed appropriate at the time. But what you couldn't envision was that the courts would run with that test, and suddenly everything with a Santa Claus or a jack-o'-lantern on it would become a festive article. It was a decoration more than the nature of the good. Certainly the drafters of this four-digit heading could not have envisioned that when they placed heading 9505 in a chapter covering toys, games, and sports equipment, that suddenly anything relating to festive holiday.
Let me go back to my question before I move to my question, which is this, I'm still a little unclear, is it the government's view that this court could overrule our precedent, or at least say our precedent no longer applies and we're going to change the precedent because of this explanatory note? Because that's what I think I read your brief as saying, and I don't see how we have the authority as a panel to overrule our precedent based on the explanatory note.
Because we're not asking you to overrule it. We're asking you to move away from it, not to overrule it, not to say at that time Park v. Smith wasn't correctly decided, at that time Midwest wasn't correctly decided. But there's now, since then, more tools at your disposal.
The explanatory note, the amended explanatory note came into being after this case that we're arguing about, sure?
That's true.
And you're then now saying, I think your argument is, this court ought to look at the new explanatory note, the amendment, that came into being after the fact of your case came to pass. Take that into consideration together with the Supreme Court decision on deference, right? And take all of that together and overrule our prior president of this court. That's really what you're saying, isn't it?
Yes, because the standard of review is different. And you can do that. I mean, you can recommend, if you believe that you don't have the authority to do that, I think that stare decisis does not apply here, and that's what I've argued in my brief. But certainly Rule 35A1 of this court allows you to recommend an en banc hearing.
But that's different. That's entirely different in my view, in my 5 or 6 years experience here. I mean, and the government has at times come in and said, yeah, circumstances have changed, here's some new authority, blah, blah, blah. This panel ought to re-urge this panel to recommend to the en banc court that they overrule as a court, that they change their precedent. But that's why I was puzzled, because that didn't seem to be clearly an appropriate course or a possible course. But you can come in on rehearing if you lose before the panel. I he raised that issue to the en banc panel, to the en banc court. But I don't understand how we are free to actually overrule it, to do anything more than arguably recommend it to the court.
Me too. You're free because the doctrine of stare decisis just doesn't apply here. Because the standard of review under which those cases were decided and the information available to you when those cases were decided has changed.
So every time there's an explanatory note that comes out after one of our precedents, another panel is free to apply that and to say we don't have to follow that precedent because there's been an intervening explanatory.
That's not this case. We're not simply arguing there's a new explanatory note. What we're arguing is that there are Supreme Court cases, not just me, but also National Cable, that direct you to review the agency's determination of an ambiguous statute. And if that
you've already done that.
Actually, you haven't under the appropriate standard. There was no need for Skidmore analysis conducted of Customs' numerous rulings interpreting this provision as applying to non-utilitarian goods only.
But doesn't our analysis clearly suggest that applying uniquely changed the result? If you just go back and sit in our shoes in terms of our precedent, is there anything there in our analysis to suggest that application of the mean difference would change the result?
Yes. And that would be the fact that you adopted an interpretive test rather than declaring the provision to be unambiguous.
The second part there, depends on then using the explanatory note as the basis.
No.
At the end of the day. The explanatory note and the things that came after it, right? Even if we're using the meaning of the note.
No, because customs interpretation of that provision dates back to the inception of the Harmonized Tariff Schedule of the United States. We cited a number of rulings, there are probably 1,000 of them on festive articles. We cited a few of them. They go back to 1989. Customs never acted inconsistently with that position until they were forced to after the Midwest decision. They had to, of course, apply this court's ruling. So Midwest was the first time that Customs acted contrary to their interpretation of 9505 as excluding utilitarian goods.
And the trial court acted in this case consistent with the existing precedent from this court.
Right. And the trial court acted as if that test existed in a vacuum, which it doesn't. As I indicated, since Park v. Smith was decided, there are new tools for you to apply. The main one is that you really are required at this point to conduct an analysis of customs position. Customs position happens to comport precisely with the amended explanatory notes. They support each other. But you really are, at this point, required, and so was the trial court, to conduct that type of analysis. And the limiting decision in this case cites your Cathedral Candle case. And in Cathedral Candle, you put forth very extensive Skidmore analysis, and the decisions here and the rulings that we are seeking deference for comport with every single one of those factors. Customs has, they've come out from Customs headquarters, so they're official, they're formal, they date back to the inception of the statute which they interpret. They've been consistent, as I indicated, Customs never wavered from that position until Midwest.
Let me just go back to a point that Judge Linares raised initially, which is that the explanatory note, even if we were to buy other aspects of your argument, the explanatory note here postdated this issue.
By a couple of months, yes. Yes.
Well, I mean, if it postdated, it could have been a month or a couple of years. Why is that the government? Your government's position is that it applies retroactively to all of the goods that were in processing? I mean,
the government's position is that you should consider the most current interpretation of a tariff statute.
We consider that interpretation in the process of the appeal, even if it wasn't in existence at the time?
Yes, because all explanatory notes do is explain the terms of the scope of a tariff provision. It's not a change. It's not, for example, a statutory change that can't be retroactive. This, as the working documents in our appendix indicate, was simply meant to clarify the scope of that provision. It was never meant to change the scope. It was clearly, it was specifically only a clarification.
But this court had already done
that. This court had not clarified. This court had adopted an interpretive text.
Right.
Based on the explanatory notes.
This purports to supersede that, and the document itself says it's not binding us on the parties to the convention.
You have to look at the overall picture here.
When this court looked at the explanatory note that existed back when Midwest and Park Smith, I guess the name of the other case, decided, they did look at the explanatory note, and they said that note doesn't exclude. Or the limitations do not include the decorated garments, right? That was part of the decision that was made. Do you agree with that?
That is what the decision said.
Were we looking at the explanatory note as it exists today, maybe a different decision would happen. But that explanatory note came afterwards, and the use, as I understand your argument, is, well, you look at the explanatory note because it's evidence of what the agency's interpretation it should have been all the time, or what their position was. What the interpretation should have been all the time. But the agency can't really overrule the president of this court by just retroactively by just passing a new explanatory note and then say, well, apply it to this case, to a case when the explanatory note didn't even exist, a new one.
Okay. The explanatory notes are not agency interpretations. They're two separate things. We're saying the explanatory notes comport with the longstanding position of the agency. The explanatory notes are actually drafted by the Harmonized System Committee, the Customs Cooperation Council, which also drafts the statute up to the first six-digit subheading. So they are the most appropriate group of people to determine what the scope of the provisions they draft is. And when you found in Park v. Smith and Midwest, there was no exclusion for utilitarian goods. You were interpreting the provision. You weren't declaring it to be unambiguous. You were saying that our reading does not bind an exclusion. Right. But you have to also concede that, indeed, the provision was silent as to whether it included utilitarian goods or non-utilitarian goods. Both the new clarification provided by the explanatory notes, as well as the standard of review that you have to apply under Mead and National Cable should lead you to determine that Park v. Smith, the test adopted in Park v. Smith and Midwest just didn't go far enough. Instead of two prongs, it needs a third prong. And that third prong is that festive articles are not utilitarian. And I see I'm into my rebuttal time. Thank you very much.
Please the court. My name is Alan Goggins from Barnes, Richards, and Colburn. I represent Michael Simon Design, plaintiff Ellie Burrell. I just want to jump right to Judge Krause, your first question. Is this panel free to overturn, and I would rephrase
Gross.
Excuse me, Judge Krause. Is this panel free to overturn multiple CASC precedents based on a change in a non-binding extrinsic source such as the explanatory? I think the answer is an obvious no. Sacco said just that. Until those precedents, and this is indeed the fourth time this court has discussed the scope of heading 9505 festival articles. It's not just Park v. Smith, it's also Midwest, Park v. Smith, and the case Judge Mayers are familiar with, Russ Perry. All three of those cases address the scope of heading 9505 festival articles. And indeed, until a panel on bank overturns those precedents, or the Supreme Court overturns those precedents, or the statute is changed, the decisions of this court are the law of the land and the final authority on the interpretation of the statute. Now, we've had a lot of discussion as to whether there's a lot of argument in the government's brief as to whether that statute or whether this court's prior decisions are ambiguous. I don't see anything in the language that's ambiguous. Indeed, Park v. Smith, indeed, it's clearly established that utilitarian articles can be used in others. What is ambiguous about that? I don't see anything ambiguous about it.
What about Judge Romero's point that even assuming that somehow we have an ability to overrule our precedent in light of an intervening explanatory note, what about the fact that the explanatory note postdates?
Okay, that's a very good point. Let's be clear on the time frame here, the timeline. The import shipments occurred. The merchandise first arrived July of 2003. The explanatory note went into effect August 2003. The entrants were not liquidated, which is the final ascertainment of the duties owed on these shipments, until after August 2003. The liquidation is what is protested. The protest is what's in court right now. So indeed, the explanatory notes are a suitable subject to be looked at.
Wait, so you think the explanatory notes do apply?
The explanatory note amendment. The explanatory note amendment shouldn't be disregarded because it occurred prior to the shipments in question. It should be considered because it occurred prior to the liquidation of the entries in question.
But your answer is that...
On the merits law, that's a procedural question. On the merits law, the explanatory note is in direct conflict with multiple precedents from this court.
But if the court didn't have the ability or the opportunity to consider the explanatory, this new explanatory note in those precedents, does that give us a basis that coupled with me to say, okay, we're going to visit this question anew?
Yes, me is a good point. The me decision occurred prior to both Park v. Smith and Rusberry. So me was already out there. As far as Park v. Smith and Rusberry. It wasn't available at the time of the last, but it was out there already. And indeed, the whole point is here, and the National Cable, another case, there is no gap to fill here. There's no ambiguity. There's no discretion left. The prior precedents of this court have looked at this statute, interpreted that statute, and said it is clear. There's no exclusion for utilitarian articles.
It was clear in light of the explanatory note that existed at that time, because we looked at the statute, we looked at the explanatory note, and said there doesn't contain exclusion for utilitarian goods, or that's in barrel, or whatever it is.
No, what this court does first, they look at the statute. If the statute is clear, they don't go any further.
But the court did go further.
The court did look at the explanatory note.
He looked at the statute, then he looked at the explanatory note that existed at the time, said we don't find an exclusion here, therefore we're going to formulate this test. Now an exclusion does exist, which you say we ought to consider. You just conceded that. So if we consider that now, doesn't it now beg the question, shouldn't we go back now that it does exclude it explicitly, go back and say now we're going to miss the whole issue, using the need, their friends, and everything.
The whole point of the explanatory note amendment, though, you're really going down a difficult path here if you agree with that analysis. Because what you are setting this court up for, every time there is a judicial precedent of this court, all the Customs Service has to do to overturn that precedent is to get together with the fellow administrative agencies and the WCO, pass an amendment to the explanatory notes, and then relitigate the case again and again and again. And that's what's happening here. You're opening up an avenue, a path where this court could become irrelevant.
But we're not irrelevant. We're the ones who get the final say to say whether or not we're persuaded by the new explanatory note.
That's exactly the point. This court has already looked at the provision, the statutory provision, and interpreted it. And that interpretation is clear, unambiguous. Now to turn around and say, okay, Customs disagreed with that decision, we'll let them amend the explanatory notes and then we'll look at it again and come up with a different decision, doesn't make any sense. You're opening up an avenue where the Customs Service could relitigate every case that they disagree with at most.
Well,
This is the fourth time this issue.
So if we were to take your position then, the effect of our position today would be to that the explanatory note with the exclusion has no meaning. But that exclusion is disregarded going forward.
I think the position of the court that I would like to see is that prior precedent of this court is a greater authority than a non-binding extrinsic source, such as.
So that explanatory note noted by practically then becomes meaningless, right? Because he has explicit exclusion there. So if we say no, the Parkey Smith still applies, and the other cases of Midwest still applies, the explanatory note means nothing. Correct.
That is correct.
In regard to the apparel issue.
In conflicts between this court's precedent and the explanatory notes, this court's precedent wins. And that's clear. There are a number of decisions to say that Lonza is a good example. Conflicts between this court's interpretation of the statute, and the explanatory notes, this court's interpretation for that. And indeed, you can't get a more clear conflict here.
This court's statutory fix.
The statute was amended as of February 3rd, 2007. That is one of the three mechanisms for not overturning prior precedent of this court, but making prior precedent of this court no longer applicable.
So this whole issue that we're resolving today, it only applies to liquidations that occurred before.
It applies to entries up through 2007, up through February 2nd, 2007. The statute went into effect, applied to shipments going forward.
And that statute, you agree, excludes apparel for this debt?
Yes, that statute, as amended, changes the.
So the effect of our decision is up to 2007.
That's correct. I just wanted to bring some striking similarities and differences between this case and the Russ Berry case. In that case, the merchandise was festive holiday earrings with symbols closely associated with
distributors. Before you go on, I'm looking at the slate submissions for additional authority. I don't have it, maybe it's at this place, but I don't have the citation to the new statute. Did anyone submit that?
The new statute is the HCSUS as of February 3rd, 2007. It was amended by the ITC, and then the next step is the presidential proclamation putting it into effect.
Did you submit it to our attention?
Yeah, I think it was addressed in the briefs. The statutory amendment was addressed in the briefs. It was addressed at the end of both briefs. Just to get back to Russ Berry very quickly, I'm sure Judge Mayer is familiar with this case and may have already thought of the similarities and differences between that case and this one. In that case, the festive merchandise was a holiday.
But nobody argued in Russ Berry that the jewelry was utilitarian,
correct? No one argued that they were utilitarian, but the merchandise was used to adorn the person in celebration of Christmas and Halloween. Here, the merchandise is used to adorn the person in celebration of Christmas and Halloween. On those facts, the merchandise is exactly the same type of merchandise. And Russ Berry said it meets the definition of festive articles. The difference between Russ Berry in this case, the binding chapter notes, which are part of the statute, address the tiebreaker between festive articles and the apparel provision. And there is no 1T to section 11, which kicks apparel out if it meets the definition of festive articles. Same exclusionary note involved in the Parkey Smith case. In Russ Berry, there was no tiebreaker chapter note like that, so you had to go to a relative specificity analysis. That's the only difference between the two cases.
Where in your brief do you cite that statute?
Right at the end.
I got it. You're talking about page 28, huh? Okay, go ahead. Go ahead and drive it.
In conclusion, Michael Simon respectfully asks this court to issue a strong decision affirming the trial court law. Without such a decision, without such a strong decision, I believe this litigation will continue again and again and again. This is the fourth time this issues the Festival of Arts.
Well, with the statutory change that's in effect now, at least there is some, maybe some hope in sight.
Yes, but there are, in addition to the Michael Simon cases, there are a whole bunch of additional Festival of Arts cases pending before the trial court.
During this period.
Three statutory amendment cases because the government has refused to follow this court's precedent. And indeed, if you want to talk about deference, I'd like to see some deference to this court's prior precedent. The Customs Service has ignored this court's prior precedent for years now. We're coming up on the 10th anniversary of Midwest next month, and it's 10 years and we're still here talking about festive articles and whether utilitarian merchandise can fit under that provision. I think a broad, strongly worded review of the defendant's position in this case could hopefully put an end to this litigation, this duplicative and unnecessary litigation in Michael Simon's opinion. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mr.
Won't fix everything.
So it won't fix anything.
It really won't fix anything.
If your position prevails, you can do this out of it, right?
Not at all. The reason the new statute won't fix anything is because the ITC has to adopt breakouts that will retain duty-free status for any merchandise that would have been duty-free previously, even though they're now, garments specifically would now be classifiable in the garments provision. And the United States and its trading partners, this is a garment case. I mean, it is a utilitarian goods case, it is a fist of articles case, but it's a garment case. And garments, we have a lot of international obligations regarding garments.
And can you clarify your first point, though, which is that the statute isn't going to fix the situation?
The statute will not fix the situation because although it will now have these goods classified in the correct statute, the correct tariff provision, it will not have them dutiable at the correct rate. Because in what the trial court did here, and what Midwestern Park v. Smith did, was to say that any good that would be classifiable as a festive article, which is a duty-free provision, will now have to be remain duty-free, because revenue neutrality is one of the mandates ITA, the International Trade Administration. They are required when they recommend breakouts to tariff provisions to maintain revenue neutrality. So the fact that garments with jack-o'-lanterns on them.
So there's no way that Congress could fix our precedent?
There's no way that Congress.
They seek
presumably Congress could say no. In this case, we don't want to maintain revenue neutrality, but that's not what will happen. Well, what is happening since February 07, when this new statute came into effect? So,
I'm still a little confused why they would have to set out this breakout, as you call them.
Because 19 U.S.C. 3005. Mandates that changes in the tariff maintain revenue neutrality, or that the ITA recommend revenue neutrality. So,
for all items that would classify this festive article.
Well, times when articles are suddenly put in a different tariff provision, they have to remain dutiable at the rate they were dutiable before.
So, what's the point of ever making the change?
Well, here it was to clarify that these articles should never have been festive articles in the first place. It was to resolve the fact that the statute is silent or ambiguous about the inclusion or exclusion of utilitarian goods. But it doesn't resolve the dutiable problem.
Well, that becomes a big enough problem. I'm sure they can fix it. They're always sticking little things in there in the Customs field for people.
agency does not change the explanatory notes. The customs, we didn't even recommend this explanatory note change, so that's just not how things are done. The explanatory notes explain what the scope of the provision was going dating back to the inception of the harmonized tariff system of the United States. I'm sorry, the harmonized tariff system up to the six-digit level. Thank you very much.
All rise.